Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Ty Burr, who has a book, Gods Like Us, on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. Ty Burr is the film critic for the Boston Globe. This particular book deals with the nature of celebrity and how it relates to the history of Hollywood and moving on up to what it is to be a celebrity today, expanding into the area of the internet. How did you come to the concepts behind this book?
I grew up studying film. I've always been into classic film. And as a film critic for, you know, a major metropolitan daily, I'm covering all the new stuff that comes out. And I just realized nobody had done a sort of overarching soup-to-nuts study of modern fame and movie stardom from the very beginning of the film industry, you know, in the 1890s, to today, when the rules have changed, the tools have changed, everything has changed about what it is to worship celebrities and be a celebrity.
Where did you go for your sources beyond the standard knowledge of the origins of Hollywood?
I didn't do any primary research, but I see the book as kind of a synthesis of a lot of Hollywood history, classic and modern. It's also an industrial history. You can't talk about movie stardom without talking about the factories that made it. And those factories have changed over the decades. I watched a lot of films, especially of stars I hadn't really studied before and thought about before. The book is aimed at a general reader who knows something about movies, but may not know how to connect the dots, or may not have had those various eras connected. It's not for somebody who is already, you know, a expert on everything movies. They'll find stuff there that they probably already know, but maybe put together in ways that will surprise them and make them think. These were these figures who were bigger than us, different than us, up there, larger than life on a wall, but we wanted to know about them. You know, and in one sense, the book is about the history of secrets, about the history of secrets being revealed. And in the earliest days, this biggest first secret was the name, because in the first 15 years of the film industry, stars were not billed by name. All you get was the title and the name of the company that made it. And letters would pour into the studios saying, please tell us their names. And actresses would get letters saying, tell me your name. I won't tell anybody, please. So finally, some of the executives figured it out. From there, you go on to wanting to know more. So if you know the name, you want to know how they live. You want to know what you want to know secrets, because you want to get to the bottom of what it is that makes them seem special.
But they're supposedly acting. The idea is that this is their job, but that's not how people viewed it at that time.
That's not how people view it today. I mean, that's one of the things about celebrity, is that we believe that these personas are really who these people are. One of the ideas in the book is that every movie star has a persona, and that persona is an idea, and the films are merely variations on the idea. So we go to see movie stars that we like to see them work out. You know, what happens if Betty Davis shoots her lover down in cold blood? What happens if she gets a brain tumor and she has to stop being spoiled? You know, if you like Clark Gable, he's going to be doing something vaguely different in every movie, and he's sort of going to be testing out the limits of his persona. And we're drawn to that in part because we want to know who we are. You know, it helps to figure out aspects of our identity and ways to behave in the world to watch these larger-than-life figures act out their variations. And in fact, a lot of the stars would talk about how they would take aspects of their personas and use them in real life, and sort of reverse engineering personality from their own personas.
You give the example, Ty Burr, of Cary Grant, who was really kind of like three people. He was Cary Grant, the actor in a role, Cary Grant, the movie star, mm-hmm. which they, back in those days, kind of assumed was Cary Grant. And then there was Archie Leach, the real person who may or may not have had anything to do with Cary Grant, but he played the part.
He played the part, and he built it well. You know, he's gone on the record saying, I tried to become this person until I became him, or he became me. That's the famous quote. But all stars have their version of that quote. One of the quotes I love in the book is John Wayne late in life saying, when I was young, I went to work on what I called the John Wayne thing. I practiced in front of a mirror. And I just love that image of a young John Wayne looking at himself in the mirror and trying to create this icon that his greatest fans don't even think of him as an actor. They think that it's real. So obviously he was very good at it, and in fact his greatest performance is as that persona.
What's the difference between that and what we call branding?
It's more self-conscious about it now. I don't think there is any difference. That word was not in the vernacular then in that sense, but certainly MGM understood that Clark Gable was a brand, and they marketed him. And, you know, think about Louis B. Mayer and the publicity department of MGM. Here is this young kid. They haven't really paid attention. He's in 12 movies in 1 year, and all of a sudden, all the women in America are going nuts over him. What do? You put him in more movies, opposite different actresses to see which ones really strike sparks. You put him in, you have him play different kinds of roles. Then you go out and you tweak the persona. You know, and they had him, had photo shoots with him hunting and fishing and playing polo, and he would pick up those things in real life because he still hadn't kind of figured out who he was.
They could maneuver the persona somewhat, but you couldn't step outside of it.
Well, you couldn't step outside of it unless, of course, you were a great actor or a great actress, you know, in the sense that, you know, Meryl Streep can do whatever she wants. You know, the great actor Alec Guinness could do whatever. We expect changeability from them, and we reward them with this aura of great thespians. Movie stars, in a weird way, have it tougher because they are locked into persona, and there's only so much they can do to break out of that.
Well, according to Mick LaSalle of The Chronicle, you can kind of break performances down into what he would call impersonation versus iconography, whereas the impersonator would be someone like Streep, who we expect to be an impersonator, and he said for Streep that's the icon itself,
right.
But for any actor, versus the person who gives an iconic performance, which is sort of like them, only on an exaggerated level.
Right. It's an almost a perfected version of who they're projecting, which may not have anything much to do with who they are in life. You know, Bogart worked at Warner Brothers for a long time, cast as a villain, cast in secondary roles, and then, you know, it's an argument for leaving certain stars outside to age like scotch or firewood. You know, at a certain point, he became heroic. He had the right roles, you know, High Sierra and the Maltese Falcon, but he discovered a way to be iconic in a way that he hadn't been able to put together earlier in life. And sometimes it kicks in and sometimes it doesn't. And I'm not sure how many stars are able to control that iconography. They coast on it. If they're lucky, they you know, they hit their marks. And even today, I'm not sure how much many stars are able to sort of control their brand. I think they have more leverage and leeway today. I think, you know, a powerful star like, you know, George Clooney, who we don't think of as an actor, but we think of him as a star, but we also recognize that he's a quite good actor, but he is clearly in control of his brand. He's writing scripts. He's producing movies. He goes from mainstream movies to the Coen brothers. He is very canny about reinventing himself from project to project, just enough so that he still has this aura of being in control in one case.
What does this all say about us as people? What does it say that we need to look for these people to pay attention to? I mean, when I hear about Snooki, you know, well, first of all, I don't watch the show, so I don't know who Snooki is other than the name.
Oh, you must. It's an object lesson in celebrity.
Or the Kardashians. Right. I mean, why would people even give a damn? At least, say, the royal family. They're the royal family, but these people are nobody.
Well, because after 100 years, we are addicted to fame. One of the things I argue in the book is that over 100 years, over a century of movie stardom and celebrity, the culture has changed. We've become, to a large degree, a culture of narcissism, of looking in the mirror, of expecting that if you are famous, you don't have to be famous for something, you just have to be famous. And now we have the tools to do so, both in reality TV, where the ordinary is celebrated, and of course, that, you know, that's sold to us as real life, but of course it's highly edited and highly shaped. Then there's the internet, where we can be as many personas as we want on Facebook and Tumblr and Second Life, and we now have the tool. We have the tools. The average person has the tools of self-celebration that only the studio gatekeepers had 75 years ago.
But why is that necessarily necessary? I mean, for me, I like doing my interviews, and to do the interviews, I have to be heard, but I actually don't want somebody to recognize my voice walking down the street. That's creepy.
Well, yes, and I've talked with stars when I've interviewed them for the paper where you get a sense that they've made a bit of a devil's bargain. You know, they're happy for their work, they're happy for their fame, and on a daily level when they are hit up 30 times in the day to have a cell phone picture taken with somebody from the audience, it can get wearing. Especially when their children are photographed by paparazzi. Why? Why do people want that? Why do people want to celebrate themselves? Because everybody wants to feel special. Everybody wants to be a star. We're now in a culture that puts primary value on being unique, standing out from the crowd. I mean, King Vidor made a movie about this back in, you know, the turn of the talkies. But I also think it's a development that is a purely 20th century development, and it really has to do with the machines that broadcasts these images globally, because, of course, the film was the first global medium for iconography, for personality, for charisma, in a way that, you know, Mary Pickford could make a movie in Hollywood and it would be, you know, within a couple of months you could see it in Indonesia. Now, of course, you know, I have teenage daughters that can do that with YouTube and, you know, a home movie video camera, and they can, in theory, be seen around the globe within an afternoon.
Well, do you think it has anything to do? I've been thinking about this, too. There seems to have been a changeover, say, during the Reagan years, where suddenly the me generation of the 70s took over, and outside of certain areas, people were no longer thinking of community. They were thinking about me, me, me. Mm-hmm. And it also shows the rise of someone, say, like, you know, the philosophy of Ayn Rand.
Right. The other thing that happened in the 80s was, in terms of star culture, was the return of glamour. Because in the 60s and 70s, audiences had suddenly lionized people who looked like them. Dustin Hoffman instead of Robert Redford. I mean, you know, the classic anecdote, of course, is, you know, Robert Redford auditioned for The Graduate and was turned down, and Dustin Hoffman got it. And all these sort of unwashed young actors came in, Jack Nicholson, Robert De Niro, the list goes on, and they felt more like us. And in fact, every generation of audiences and consumers kill off their parent stars and choose stars that feel more like them. But what happened in the Reagan era in the 80s is you went from, you know, Hoffman to Tom Cruise. I say you went from Mensch Triumphant to Aryan Resurgent. We wanted glamour figures. We wanted larger-than-life muscle men like Sylvester Stallone. It wasn't a good period for actresses, neo-noir sirens or, you know, shady ladies, but not particularly realistic portrayals. But I think the return of glamour upped the value and meaning of celebrity. It wasn't that you could just be your own shabby self and that was enough. You had to have some extra glow to you.
You keep saying we. I wasn't part of that we necessarily.
Maybe not, but when I talk about we, I talk about the larger culture and the way that the larger culture moves. And I think, you know, even though you or I might say, no, I don't do that, I think there are aspects of the psychology of audience consumption of celebrity that we share. And we may choose different celebrities. You may not say, oh, I don't care about Tom Cruise, but, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis, that's what feeds that urge for you.
When I'm going to see a Meryl Streep movie or a Daniel Day-Lewis movie, I'm also looking at quality. I'm not necessarily giving a damn about who Daniel Day-Lewis is in his private life. I couldn't care less.
Okay, well, I still think part of the mystery of the quality is that he projects this mercurial gift. It's a skill. It's a talent. And we want to know more about that. Streep is interesting in that nobody's ever really truly been curious about her private life. The relationship that most moviegoers have with Meryl Streep is actually sort of a privileged one, in that we go to her for the performances, we go to her for the sense that she's finding joy in these performances, especially recently, and that's enough. And there are certain stars that have the respect of an audience where we let them be. Jodie Foster is another example, where we really don't, you know, there's stuff there to be dug up if you wanted to, but nobody wants to, because the bargain she has made with us is that she gives us good, thoughtful, creative performances, and she doesn't play the diva in real life.
When we're talking about movie stars and what they've done, I know a lot of people who, for instance, won't watch a Woody Allen movie after what happened with Sun Yi, yet at the same time, we're not necessarily going to think about, say, what a bastard Jeffrey Archer is if someone likes his books. What distinguishes, do you think, someone like Woody Allen, who's a filmmaker, from someone like, say, Jeffrey Archer, who, to all intents and purposes, is not a good person?
But Woody Allen isn't just a filmmaker. He's a persona. He's a persona out. He's this character out there in the culture. And, of course, that character doesn't necessarily jibe with the person he actually is. And this is the lesson we learn over and over again, to our great cultural shock, when Clint Eastwood gets up there and addresses an empty chair. And, oh, wait a minute, he's not. You know, Clint Eastwood has been through so many persona changes over this long arc of his career. At one point, he was, you know, the Neanderthal of Dirty Harry, and or the hero, depending on where you came from. And then he became, you know, the John Ford of our generation, you know, this great auteur. And now he's kind of the cranky uncle of the Republican Party. So you can't just say Woody Allen's just a filmmaker. We put value on him as a persona in a way that we don't do with George Lucas. I mean, to some degree. I mean, he's a star director, but right. not the way that Woody Allen... And Woody Allen, you have to remember, meant so much to certain audiences in the 70s. There was so much trust and love and sort of almost hope after, you know, Annie Hall won all those Oscars. He was the great, smart guy of making these funny, articulate, meaningful movies. And I think he had a strong female audience component that really cherished him for that. So this was a big betrayal on the persona level. And, of course, you know, obviously a betrayal on the domestic level.
In other words, someone like Alfred Hitchcock, say, whose persona was creepy, mm-hmm. wouldn't have that problem, or James Cameron, or, you know, Quentin Tarantino.
And also other certain stars whose persona allows for transgression. You know, the classic example I use in the book is in the 1940 trials of Errol Flynn versus Charlie Chaplin. Errol Flynn goes up for statutory rape with two teenage girls, gets acquitted, even though he certainly did it. And I love this telling detail when he's acquitted. A little girl runs up and gives him a bouquet of flowers. He's forgiven because he's Errol Flynn. Charlie Chaplin is taken to court to pay child support by a former lover. Blood tests already proved that the child could not possibly be his, but he was found guilty and had to pay child support for 18 years because he was at that moment very unpopular in the culture because of his left-wing pronouncements during the war. He was perceived as a predatory womanizer. So when comics go outside their persona and have these tawdry scandals, it's much worse than when an action hero does.
Or a writer.
Except in certain cases, like Philip Roth or Gore Vidal, their persona isn't out there in the culture, and I would argue much less so today than in, you know, the glory days of star writers.
You're listening to an interview with Ty Burr, whose book is titled Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. A few areas that you kind of cover, but I was curious about. One is you talk a lot about Madonna, who was never able to make the transition mm-hmm. to movie star. My stepbrother was the producer of her first album. He was just a guy for hire.
Uh-huh.
And I asked him about her, and his response was, well, the problem with her was that she just simply isn't talented enough to be a decent actress. I mean, even though she's talented enough, certainly, to be a decent promoter of herself. You give a completely different reason why she wasn't successful.
Well, I think that the actress thing has something to do with it. She is absolutely functional and powerful as a star. To make that transition to another medium, you have to surprise us with a good performance, the way, say, Bette Midler did in her first films, the way Whoopi Goldberg did in her first films. When you're coming from another medium, you have to stake a claim. But there's also the sense that her persona is not one that adapts well to movies, because whenever we see Madonna in a movie, we're seeing Madonna. We can't see the character. Her persona is of this headstrong diva who's very canny in a good way, and creates her persona, creates the stage show around it in a way that's very attractive. Headstrong's the wrong word, just, you know, almost dominant in a good sense. She's a very powerful figure in the pop music sphere and in the cultural sphere. But that almost overwhelms her when she's trying to play a role. We can't see the character for the static that Madonna as a persona brings to the movie. Her ambition almost gets in the way. I mean, she really wanted that Oscar for Evita, but A, the performance wasn't surprising enough. B, it was Madonna we were seeing. We never saw Evita.
So if she had been better, she might have been able to transcend that.
I think if she'd been able to deliver more nuanced performances, and also in parts that would surprise us, she might have had to take a risk in a completely unexpected kind of role, and I'm not going to be the one to suggest what it was, but often you will see that when somebody comes from outside the movie industry, they take a flyer and try and do, you know, oh, think of Mark Wahlberg, who was a laughingstock. Nobody took him seriously, and then he lucks out, meets up with P.T. Anderson, goes into Boogie Nights, and he comes out this lionized talent.
You also don't talk about the attempt in the past 20 years to manufacture stars. I have a list of people. They were called stars, but they never really were stars. People like Colin Farrell, Matthew McConaughey, Kate Hudson, Julia Ormond, Katherine Hagel.
Yeah, well, the star factory still exists, but it's not nearly as successful as it was when the studios were running it. When the studios had this monolithic business of that created a paradox. They mass-produced unique personalities. When the studios fell apart, that fell into flux. The ability to create stars fell into different hands. And for a while there in the 80s and 90s, it was in the hands of the agents and the publicists and the managers. Now I think that it's actually in the hands of a lot of the stars themselves. If they're forward-thinking about it and get the right sort of team, they can go from different kinds of movies, small movies to big ones. You know, somebody like Charlize Theron or Halle Berry will say, well, I've been playing this glamour girl, but now I'm going to just play a monster in a movie called Monster or Monster's Ball, and I'm going to, you know, see if I can win an Oscar. Then now they're suddenly a different kind of star. I think it's true that audiences have become resistant to the idea of, oh, here's a new star, you will go see his movies or her movies. And we sometimes don't bite. We're savvier. For one thing, we don't need them as much as we used to because we can celebrate ourselves in very real ways. So this is why you get Ben Affleck coming out of Good Will Hunting and saying, I'm Daredevil, I'm a romantic lead. And people didn't bite. And in fact, he became this laughingstock, and only when he turned around and started directing movies did he become respected again. Matthew McConaughey is another example where Hollywood put him in all these movies where they tried to position him as either a serious actor or a young heartthrob. They put him into chick flicks. And nobody really bought it. And he was ridiculed until he started doing really interesting, not just character work that earned him respect, but that actually plays into parts of his persona that we like, which is this sort of oily but almost superior sleazebag, but a smart sleazebag in a way that is fun to watch. So his most recent performances have been greeted really well by audiences and critics alike. He's found his way into this persona that always existed as an idea, but now actually works on a film-to-film basis.
Well, there's something else going on, which is kind of disturbing, which is the idea that a celebrity suddenly is a polymath and could do anything. So, I mean, if Matt Damon decided he wanted to be film critic for the Boston Globe and wrote decently, he could replace you.
Well, because he's got value. He's got star value. He's got value in the marketplace. His name, his celebrity, gives him a value and a face in a way that you and I don't have. We don't have faces, and are not faces anybody wants to look at. Not me. I can't speak for you.
Then it also translates to the Broadway stage. You know, you don't even go to Broadway necessarily to see the best acting, because it's movie stars or
movie properties.
And then you've also got voiceovers for cartoons. There are no more June Forays or Mel Blanks. They're all Jim Carrey.
No, because each of those carries a monetary value. Whether it's a voiceover, you know, done by Adam Sandler in Hotel Transylvania, or a Broadway star appearing, like Chris Rock in that play that I can't say the title of on the radio, it gets bodies in the seats. It's a selling point. They have monetary value. In a weird way, it's interesting. Movie stars in movies are not as financially powerful as they used to be. With a very few exceptions, stars cannot guarantee $100 million at the box office the way they used to. What sells now in movies are franchises and special effects. Yeah, sure, Kristen Stewart is a big star, but only on the basis of Twilight. There are no real stars of the Transformers movies, and these are the movies that make huge, huge amounts of money. But stars still have value in other arenas. In a weird way, they're carrying over their clout, their markers of monetary meaning into subsidiary ventures like theater, like reality TV, where you get into the D and Z level stars. They still have value.
But it's a degrading of quality.
Certainly it can be a degrading of quality, but the audience doesn't care. They just know that they're getting a name they know. They know that they're getting a brand. So it's not June Foray, you know, who was voiced every cartoon we grew up with, and we recognize her, but she was never a star in her own right because she was kind of invisible. Nevertheless, if you are your average family going out to the movies, yes, it's an added bonus that the people doing the voices in this family film you're going to go see are people you've heard of. It gives you a little thrill, like they're doing something for you. It's in a weird way, it's almost the same thing that animates celebrity tweets and celebrity Twitter feeds. And everybody I know subscribes to a bunch of celebrity Twitter feeds, whether they're done by the stars themselves or not. That itself is an arena for further persona games. I mean, I love following, you know, Albert Brooks's Twitter feed, and I hear he spends a lot of time sort of agonizing before he punches that send button.
Ty Burr, there is the theory, of course, that what we're looking at is, in fact, the old bread and circuses thing. Keep us engaged with celebrities so that the powers that be, the corporate powers, can do whatever the hell they please, and we're going to be more interested in Snooki than in the fact that we're going to lose our Medicare.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, celebrity is one of the great narcotics of the 20th century, and even more so in the 21st century. If we're fascinated with these people, and increasingly it's a matter of looking into a mirror that includes us, we're not going to be paying as much attention to what else is going on. And, you know, the six major media behemoths that give us our entertainment in the modern day, they're not necessarily pursuing a political agenda. They want to make money. They want to make profits. And stars are money in the bank, less so in mainstream movies than they used to be, but they still have huge value. So I think that the people who and the companies that create stars, create this entertainment machine, are very, very, very well aware that we're drawn to it because it keeps us wrapped. It keeps us not paying attention to other things. It keeps us paying. And they're very, very aware of our desire to be celebrities ourselves. Why do you think those the Us magazines and the People magazines make so much money? And Us has that, you know, regular photo feature. Stars, they're just like us.
But, of course, they're not necessarily, and we don't necessarily want them to be.
No, but we are drawn, again, this is part of the secret, you know, getting behind the mask to what we think is the real person. Yeah, we want to see Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner, you know, in sweatpants and sweatshirts pushing their kid around in a stroller. Again, when I say we, maybe not you and me, I'm talking about as a culture, because that makes money.
What relation do you think it has, if any, and would this have happened anyway if Rupert Murdoch hadn't taken the lowest elements of gossip from Britain and brought them over to America?
Well, there's always been a strain of scurrilous gossip in movie culture. The lid came off in the 20s with the early 20s star scandals, Fatty Arbuckle, Wallace Reid dying of his morphine addiction, and that was the first time the real secret had been revealed, and we saw what, you know, the dark secret. In the 50s, you had Confidential magazine, which was, you know, about to write nasty things about Rock Hudson, so they married him off to the studio secretary. It's always been there. People magazine came along in the 70s, but it was still pretty genteel. But I do agree that with Murdoch came in a importing of a coarser brand of celebrity culture, and I don't think it was just him. I think he might have helped open the door that now exists 24/7 on the internet, in the news magazines, everywhere you look on TV. It's gotcha journalism, but it's also star persona that has hopped off the screen. Star persona is almost more important now off the screen than it is on the screen. I always found it very interesting that the year that Sandra Bullock had her big comeback a couple of years ago, where she won an Oscar and was in a couple of movies, one was a big hit, another was critically acclaimed, and she wasn't really put over as a big star until she had a divorce scandal and was on the cover of People magazine for like 3 months running.
But that also has to do with the manufactured media narratives. I mean,
absolutely.
They're always looking for that.
Right, and you're absolutely correct that they need those narratives, and often they depart from reality, but they're an alternate storyline. And in fact, they're, for many in the audience, they're a more interesting storyline because they're not just 2 hours long. You can keep following them for weeks and weeks. And this has, of course, its roots in old Hollywood, when the studio publicity departments would create these narratives. It has to do with narratives that existed outside of the publicity departments, Kate Hepburn and Spencer Tracy. Personally, I think it really took off when Liz and Dick ran away. You know, Liz left Eddie for Richard Burton during Cleopatra, and that became all of a sudden the more important narrative, much more interesting than anything that was happening on the screen. There's an anecdote I tell in the book. It's well known that when Liz Taylor came into the arena to shoot a scene as Cleopatra, and the extras were supposed to scream, "Cleopatra, Cleopatra," and they all started yelling, "Liz, Liz, Liz," at that moment, her persona hopped off the screen and became more important to the culture outside of the movies, to the point where she didn't really need to make movies anymore to be a star. She was really the first person for whom that was true.
What about narratives are created which may not have to do with the individual, and then the individual does something themselves, and what will happen is rather than the narrative changing, somehow the star has stepped out of their lives.
Oh, you mean when a star behaves not according to the rules of their persona and they're punished for it?
Particularly if the persona isn't necessarily one they created themselves.
Yeah. Well, I always think of Meg Ryan, who became America's sweetheart in the 90s, really only for doing, you know, three movies, When Harry Met Sally and two movies with Tom Hanks. If you actually look at her filmography, she did a fair amount of challenging roles, but that was not her persona in the public eye. Those three films were hugely successful and really set who she was, so much so that when she had an affair with Russell Crowe on the set of Proof of Life in the year 2000 and left her husband Dennis Quaid, she was pilloried in the press, in the People magazine press. She was labeled an unfit mother, then subsequently did a movie called In the Cut with Jane Campion, where she did nudity, and it was very sort of raw, cutting-edge sexuality, and it was as if the cultural body recoiled because she was not playing according to the rules of Meg Ryan, of who Meg Ryan was supposed to be. Now, if it had been Angelina Jolie, the script would have been completely different. That's what Angelina Jolie does. She steals husbands, or she cheats on husbands and is transgressive.
If this is what it's like to be one of these stars, no wonder that they spend their time on drugs and they have to hide out, because after a while, that could be overwhelming, because the relationship between the persona and the person becomes so split, and it's out of their control.
It is absolutely out of their control, and I think it takes a strong, smart, and mature actor to deal with that. And you look at the people who are negotiating it successfully, and they've been around the block, and you look at the people who spin out, you can tell that that split has widened to the point where they've lost their moorings. And I think about, you know, Mel Gibson, who is no longer in control of his message of who he is, and has lost it to such a degree that his value as a celebrity has almost inverted. But then again, you look at somebody like Robert Downey Jr., who, you know, 10 years ago he was arrested for speeding on drugs with a gun in his car and was thrown in jail, and with another actor, that career would have been over completely, and yet now he's starring in movies and we love him. We never stopped loving him. There's a charm about him that allows us to indulge his weakness, and as long as he didn't go too far and didn't hurt somebody else, it was always seemed, you know, the impression was that he was his own victim more than he was somebody else's, which isn't true with the public narrative of what Mel Gibson's been doing.
But on the other hand, the thing about narratives, as we know, is the best narrative is the underdog coming back to
Absolutely.
The surface.
Correct.
Which means that it's possible for virtually anybody, including Fatty Arbuckle, who was being reevaluated,
right.
to return.
Too bad he's dead.
Well, that's a minor problem. That there are always second acts and if someone wants to make one.
There are always second acts and third acts and fourth acts. And in fact, I think the culture of celebrity involves reinvention today on such a regular level where even the biggest movie stars understand that they have to go make indie movies, and if they want critical respectability, but then have to go make a big, stupid, you know, fluffy mainstream movie if they want the cash, or go on TV and do this and do that and constantly be involved in this creation of a reinvented self, at the core of which is hopefully an interesting persona. Because reinvention is such an accepted part of the celebrity game now, that there's always a chance for a comeback. Is that going to happen with Mel Gibson? It may take an awful long time, but I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility.
The media will build this up. The corporate media loves this
Absolutely.
Stuff.
Absolutely. Well, look at what Tom Cruise is trying to do. I mean, there's somebody whose persona fell off the rails when he fired his longtime publicist, who really was as involved as any classic-era studio and manufacturing and protecting that persona, when he fires Pat Kingsley and goes on Oprah and bounces up and down on the couch in what he thought was a real portrayal of what a man in love should look like, and had no idea that that would not only misfire, and if that had happened before the internet era, it would have been the butt of jokes for a week on Letterman, we would have forgotten it, but then it's completely repurposed by the internet cargo cult and goes out there and it's there forever. What did he do? He did a character part in Tropic Thunder where he puts on a baldy wig and padding and plays a most un-Tom Cruise-like character in a way that got people to say, oh, he's interesting again. And he's doing that now with some of the roles that he's doing now. He's constantly trying to reinvent himself from on a project-to-project basis. The weird thing is, do we want reinvention from Tom Cruise? I'm not sure we do. I'm not sure we know what, at this point, we want from Tom Cruise.
This can extend outward. Do we want reinvention from Jonah Lehrer or from Mike Daisy either, you know?
No, because, you know, they don't entertain us. They don't stand to entertain us in quite the same way. Look at what Joaquin Phoenix did recently, where he actually, as a conceptual cultural art prank, tried to reinvent himself as a horrible person when he grew the beard and said, I'm becoming a rapper. And it was all a joke for this mockumentary he and Casey Affleck were making. And it didn't really work because Joaquin Phoenix didn't have a really coherent persona to begin with. He's just this interesting actor, but not really a coherent, cohesive personality in the culture beyond just being an interesting actor. And I personally thought he would never come back for that. But now they're talking about him, you know, getting nominated for an Oscar in The Master. So talk about third acts and fourth acts. But there was that one reinvention that was wholly manufactured as an attempt just to play with the notion and pull the wool over the culture's eyes.
And two movies later, it's forgotten.
It is forgotten because there is no cultural long-term memory. Why think about the long-term when you've got a new shiny bauble being sold to you every week?
Ty Burr, how can we as people, as consumers, should we be pulling ourselves back from this? What should we be doing? How should we be thinking? I know this moves into other areas. How do you pull back, understanding the difference between you as the film critic for the Globe and a cultural observer, and you as, you know, a consumer or a person?
What's my prescription for cultural intervention? When it comes to celebrity culture, I think we as a society do need an intervention, especially now that we have the tools to celebrate ourselves, and we can literally spend all day in pixel land, in what I call the omniverse, which is projecting these different personas that are riffing on personas and celebrities that we see in the cultural sphere. And it's this big echo chamber. And I do think it's dangerous. And I do think it devalues the idea of reality. Remember reality? You know, that's a good thing. So how do we go about taking back reality? One thing, we have to step back. One of the ways to step back, I think, is to take ourselves out of this eternal now that the entertainment industry likes to sell us, where the latest thing is the only thing that matters. That's one of the reasons I wrote my last book, which was about showing classic movies to kids. And it was both a guide, but it was also a narrative of my experience brainwashing my young children with black and white classics, which they, you know, grew up loving, but more to the point, not just, you know, turning them onto Duck Soup, more to the point, they understood that there's a wider culture out there, that there's history, that there's cultural history, that there's stuff of value in the past. Because you cannot know what's going on the present unless you understand what happened in the past. That, to me, was the greatest value in showing them these old movies and turning them on to old music and turning them on to old anything, just to try and get them out of the eternal now that is all about the corporate cell, all about the entertainment cell. I also think that, personally, I would love to intervene by just getting rid of all the gossip magazines. I personally think that they are damaging to the culture. And I know I sound like an old fuddy-duddy, and my daughters laugh at me when I stand in the line at the CVS and just look at those magazines and grumble and growl. But I find them kind of hideous, especially the subsidiary lives of the people that they're covering. You know, there are people sucked into that who don't want to become celebrities, and I'm thinking of the kids of celebrities who do. And I think it's shameful, and I think the consumption of not just those magazines, but of the whole I want to know what's going on in these people's, quote, real lives, is a way of not living your own life.
It also spreads into the political sphere when people like a Sarah Palin or an Eric Cantor or a Paul Ryan or even a Michelle Obama, but at least she's first lady, suddenly they're being treated in the same way, and we're no longer looking at the politics of America. We're looking at whether Paul Ryan can do 20 push-ups.
Politics? What, substance? You want to know about, you know, politicians have been playing the celebrity game, well, you know, arguably since Roosevelt, who I consider the first media-savvy president, but certainly since JFK, who was the first movie star president, who wasn't a movie star, and then along comes Ronald Reagan, who was a movie star. And the more savvy candidates and their people around them understand how to play that persona game and celebrity game and star game. Has it overwhelmed the culture? Sure it has, but I think it's longer than the last two election cycles. I think we've been stepping deeper and deeper into it for a long time. I also think that because of the empowerment represented by social media and new media and new feeds of expression on the part of the audience, that we're able to combat that persona so that, you know, yes, Sarah Palin may become this weird kind of cultural star, but you're not just getting her feed, you're getting all sorts of other commentary and different feeds. And, you know, yes, Mitt Romney is out there putting forth his persona, but, you know, one of my kids shows me this Twitter feed called Yo Mitt Romney, which is somebody posting as if he were an extremely profane, obscene frat boy Mitt Romney. So that's somebody hijacking a perceived persona and playing a metagame with it, which is happening all over the culture, and I actually think that's a good aspect.
So to that degree, when the culture begins looping back on itself and viewing itself and becomes its own meta-culture, on some level, it steps back.
On some level, it steps back and creates an awareness and creates a way for different voices to sort of combat the main narrative. I think that's a good thing. I think it can go too far. As I said, people have to sort of pull their heads out of the omniverse at least once a day. But I do think there's been a opening of the gate for people to play with other people's personas, with celebrity persona in a way we never could before. And it almost makes me feel sorry for traditional movie stars like Tom Cruise, who all of a sudden have their persona hijacked and played with like digital roadkill. But it's an empowering of the audience to play with ideas of personas and what they mean in a way that never happened before. We were always supposed to not obediently pay for our tickets and sit in the front row of the Bijou.
Ty Burr, okay, you've written Gods Like Us, and you're still doing the criticism. One question about your past. What was an in-house movie analyst for HBO? What does that person do?
That was my first job out of college. I was a film studies major in college, and there was a window of about 30 seconds where HBO said, you know, we've got all these Nielsen ratings. Maybe we should get somebody who knows about movies. This is HBO really in the early 80s before they started doing a lot of their own programming. So I was brought in to be a research guy, to be a movie knowledgeable research guy. And then I hopped over to the crew, what they called film evaluators. And those were essentially in-house movie critics whose job was to look at all the films that were submitted to HBO for acquisition and write up two-page evaluations that were essentially market-oriented film criticism. Here's what this movie is. Here's what it's about. Here's what will happen if you put it on at 9 p.m. Oh, by the way, here's what I think of it and whether it's actually a good movie, but they weren't terribly interested in that. They wanted to know whether it would draw viewers.
Ty Burr, now that you've finished this, two quick questions. What are you working on now? And second, when we're looking at movies over the next 6 months, outside of, I guess, The Master and Argo, what should we be looking at?
What am I working on next? I spent 5 years on this book, so I'm taking a breather. There's some filmmakers I'm thinking about writing about. I actually think that this book would make an interesting documentary series. I'm playing around with that idea. I don't have a large project on the horizon, but I'd like to. What do we have to look forward to in terms of the rest of the year? Oh, we're in kind of the Oscar silly season where all these movies announce themselves as important and we're supposed to behave as if they are important. And there are a number of movies that I haven't seen that I'm looking forward to seeing, some of which are, you know, are going to do nothing less than explain the meaning of life to us, such as Cloud Atlas, which I haven't seen yet. Some of them are more, you know, star games. We've got a new version of Anna Karenina with the latest, you know, young, brilliant actress, Keira Knightley, who I like, but I'm curious to see what she's going to do in that film. I have seen Argo. I think it's a very well-made movie. I think Ben Affleck has successfully reinvented himself as a cultural figure who's more than a joke, quite seriously. I have seen The Master, and I find that actually fascinating, not just in terms of a film, but as I mentioned, the way it reinvigorates what Joaquin Phoenix means in the culture and confirms what Philip Seymour Hoffman means in the culture, almost as one of the great character actors to the point where he's a leading man. I mean, the two best movies I've seen this year so far are Moonrise Kingdom and Beasts of the Southern Wild, and those came out in the summer. And those are, you know, especially Beasts of the Southern Wild came in through the transom. I mean, nobody was expecting anything from that until they saw it at Sundance at the beginning of the year. And here was this movie with a real genuine energy. Who's the star of that movie? Well, the little girl, the guy who made it. As we say, you know, the culture tries to create a celebrity even if there's not one readily available. So, yes, the little girl went out for interviews. And people wanted to talk with Ben Zeitlin, the guy who made it, because we needed to put a face on the experience of this movie. And he's sort of a reluctant celebrity, but he played the game well. I mean, he felt strongly about his movie and was able to articulate what he wanted to do with it. So those, to me, were the two most interesting movies I've seen so far this year. I don't know if anything's going to surprise me. I worry that the Oscar season brings these movies that take themselves too seriously and are too award-hungry to really take risks.
You've been listening to an interview with Ty Burr, whose book is titled Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. And you could read his reviews at
the Boston Globe, boston.com/movies.
I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.